We talked about brain solutions of type 2B low energy equations of motion. And you will have a tutorial, and maybe even two, on that, where you would be asked to calculate various quantities associated with those solutions and take various limits and see what happens. In particular, you'll be asked to compute the Hawking temperature entropy of these solutions, and also the same for the near horizon limit of those solutions, because mostly we'll be working with the near horizon limit of these black brain solutions. And near horizon limit will have a different asymptotic. So these solutions that I wrote on board yesterday, I didn't mention this, but you can easily look at them and see that they have this property of being asymptotically flat. So these are solutions that describe, so we have this brains that curve space-time locally, but then if you go very far away in the transverse direction, then you discover that the space-time is still 10-dimensional Minkowski space-time. It's flat. Okay? Now, when you look at the near horizon limit, you discover that the near horizon limit will be described by a different type of space-time. If you cut this asymptotically flat region, then it will be something that with the ADS asymptotics times the in the most important case 5 sphere, but times other spheres in for different values of p, and you will compute in tutorial the entropy, temperature, and combine them together. The statement of extremality. So in fact, the story is slightly more complicated than whatever is presented on board. But for people who are interested in these complexities, I just refer you to the literature. We will not need all this in the following. But let me just mention that the actual solutions. So when you look for solutions of this type 2B equations of motion, you find them in the form which resembles the Schwarzschild type solution, and it is usually, so let me use the radial coordinate rho rather than r, and it has the following form. It's a square root of minus of rho. Again, so we will not really need this, but just that you're not puzzled by various sources in the literature. So there's some coefficient 5 minus p, 7 minus p. This is a function of rho divided by f plus of rho d rho squared plus some angular piece, which I don't even want to write down, where these f plus minuses, the function of rho, is 1 minus r plus minus, so these are numbers related to the charge, over rho to power 7 minus p, right? So this is the actual solution when you plug in the ansatz, which is spherically symmetric, and you solve your equations of motion. And again, so people who want to kind of go through all this machinery in detail, let me just again refer you to lectures by Stell. But you can also look at, so there are references and some brief discussion of that that story in the AGMU. So this is this big review, one of the two big reviews that I included in your list of references. This is Aroni, Gubser, Maldacena, Aguri, Oz. Right. That's 1999. So there is a chapter on black brain solution which contains all these metrics explicitly and references to the original papers by Strominger, Horowitz, and other people, Gibbons, and so on. So again, if you want to explore this, you can just look there. What I would like to emphasize is the following. So this rho coordinate here is the analog of a Schwarzschild radial coordinate, and it goes from zero to infinity. And you can analyze the solution and look at the singularities, the coordinate singularities, but also the actual singularities by computing the curvature invariance, as we usually do. You can see from the structure of the solution that you expect the horizon. So this function f plus, which has a structure 1 minus something, right? And therefore, you expect a coordinate singularity, the horizon at rho equal to rho plus. And it appears also in the right place here, d rho squared over this function. And then there is also this f minus. And if you compute the curvature invariance, you discover that f minus would tell you that there is actually the real singularity, not the coordinate singularity. So the curvature invariance actually singular there. But it is hidden. So rho minus, r minus is if you have r minus, which is less than r plus, then the singularity is hidden by the horizon, and this solution is therefore acceptable, and that translates into the terminology of our m and q of the previous lecture, in the condition that m is greater or equal to q. Now, what is convenient to do is to redefine coordinates, and by the following relationship. So let's introduce new radial coordinate rho minus r plus to the same power 7 minus p. So this new radial coordinate, the zero of this new radial coordinate is r plus, and therefore when you substitute, so you make the substitution and you rewrite the metric, and the result of this rewriting of the metric will be exactly the metric which was appearing on the board yesterday. And then this r plus, therefore, will describe your space-time from rho equal to rho plus to infinity, right? So rho equal to infinity, and this is rho equal to rho plus. So this is outside the horizon. Okay. Now, on top of that, so this is one story, and then you can ask, okay, so what happens when, so these are two r plus and r minus, and then at some values of m and q, right, they start getting closer together, and then at some point they merge. So there's an interesting story depending on p. What happens depending on p? What happens when they merge? For d equals 3, actually it's an interesting story because nothing bad happens. Although I mentioned it's a singularity, but in the case of p equals 3, in fact, you'll recover regular space-time. Again, for us, all this machinery will not be very relevant because we are not. So from now on, we'll discuss the space-time outside of this horizon r plus. And on top of that, you might get also, so you can compute things like the entropy and temperature, and then relate, for example, so there will be some expression which depends on the parameters, and this expression depends on the parameters. Then you can combine them together and get the function of S as a function of T, which is an interesting thing to do, right? Because with an eye on the dual field theory, where in principle you want to recover some thermodynamics, right? Some sort of thermodynamics. And this thermodynamics, if you're thinking of the gauge theory, which has massless degrees of freedom, or even massive degrees of freedom, but you know, in the limit of weak coupling, if you have a theory with some number of relativistic degrees of freedom and zero density, which is important here, right? So. Okay, so let me come to this a little bit later. So, if you have a photon gas, for example, right, then by Stefan-Boltzmann law, you expect in four dimensions, for example, the entropy of this photon gas should scale as T cube. And there is no other scale in the theory at for example, V coupling, or if you want high temperature, if you have massive degrees of freedom. or the energy density, for example, will scale as t to the fourth, right, and so on. And if you have your theory, your dual theory, living at zero density of some conserved charge, that could be it could be R charge, it could be some density of some U1 charge if you're considering some theory which contains Maxwell fields and so on. So if a density of charge, so let me, so expectation value of J naught, right, so J naught is equal to zero, then you ultimately you will get relationship of this type for your gauge theory, and they will tell you that the entropy, your entropy is going to zero with zero temperature. So now this may not be the case. In fact, it is not the case in holographic models, which contains finite density, and this is not equal to zero. Then the limit of zero temperature will lead to some non-zero. So then S will go to some S naught, which depends on this charge J naught at zero temperature. So in that, and this is a generic property. Now here, the metric that I wrote last time in this new coordinate R, even if you, on top of what we had for this metric, you can introduce the finite energy density to your solution, and that would translate into the presence of this new function f. Remember, for Diffrey brains, it was 1 minus r to the fourth over, r naught to the fourth over r to the fourth. And the Hawking temperature, at least in the near horizon limit, was given by this expression, right? So in some sense, you can think of this parameter as introducing the non-zero temperature of your solution. So in the near horizon limit, that would correspond to, when you compute the horizon area, that would correspond to S being proportional for Diffrey brain to T cube. So this is part of your tutorial exercise for today. And it has this property of the horizon area being zero at extremality, where extremality would correspond to this parameter R naught, or temperature being equal to zero. And again, so this corresponds to zero external charge. So this is not the situation in which you, on top of non-zero temperature, you introduce also non-zero density of some background charge, and then this property will not hold. That we'll talk about this in condensed matter sort of applications of holography, but for these solutions, we will have this this property, right? So for the temperature will be the entropy will be zero at zero temperature, all right? It is perhaps slightly confusing because we started talking about these brain solutions already saying that there is a finite density of some conserved charge, namely the charge associated with Ramon-Ramon potential. And you may say that there was some charge already, right? So you built the solutions supported by this density of charge, and now you're telling us that no, the charge density is zero, right? So what is going on? So it's a superposition of two things here, right? And so I hope maybe in tutorials you will kind of, if you have any confusions, you will probably try to go through them, right? So indeed, we built the p-brain solutions as supported by this density of Ramon-Ramon charge, but then we do something to them, so these solutions will have this R minus and R plus, right? So there is also a story about considering the black hole solutions versus brain solutions. So notice that here we built our solutions as solutions of type 2b equations of motion, and by design, these solutions are Poincaré symmetric, right? So they have flat horizons. You can do different things. You can consider, and in your tutorial last week, you consider it, for example, anti-de Sitter or AdS Schwarzschild black holes as spherically symmetric objects and with horizons which have spherical symmetry. And you may wonder what is the relationship between the black holes and black brains. And that, I think, it might be a good idea to do a tutorial on Thursday to how to pass from one to another. It's to some degree, it can be thought of as, let's say, the Poincaré patch of the global AdS. But for pragmatical reason, sometimes you just need to pass through the metric which describes the black hole, from metric which describes black hole to metric which describes a black brain. And from pragmatical reason, it's a simple operation because you can view the black brain in some appropriate limit as some appropriate limit of a black hole, right? So you can think of some black hole with spherical symmetry. But if your radius of your black hole is very large, then looking locally, the surface of this of the horizon, right, of black hole would look almost flat. And if the horizon radius is infinitely large, then you have to take some rescaling limit, and in this rescaling limit you go to a flat Poincaré horizon, right? So you will see how it works in one example that I have in mind. So maybe on Thursday in tutorials. So here, indeed, this thing is supported by this Ramon charge. But then, on top of that, right? So if you now introduce this coordinate r, and you consider only spacetime outside of this horizon rho equal to r plus, then on top of that, right? So now instead of r plus, you have r equal to zero. That is your horizon. And now on top of that, you can introduce a solution. You can prove that this is a solution of equations of motion, where you have an extra horizon at r equal to r naught, and that corresponds to non-zero temperature. Okay. And in addition to that, you can also make this solution charged under some U1 charge, which is not related to this Ramon thing at all, right? So some background which sits in the bulk and obeys some equations of motion with coupled other fields, scalars, and so on. And that will complicate things even further because in addition to this new horizon r equal to r naught, you might have other horizons or other structures in your solution, and then depending on what will happen to various parameters, you may or may not have entropy equal to zero when temperature is equal to zero. If you introduce this additional charge, okay. So this may sound somewhat confusing, but hopefully by the end of this week we will use concrete examples so that this confusion will somehow evaporate. So at least I hope that it will. All right. So now let's proceed. Let's proceed with constructing the AdS CFT dictionary. Well, AdS CFT. Correspondence. Right. So we'll consider elements of string theory again. So perturbatively, string theory is a theory of open and closed strings. But non-perturbatively, and that means and I say perturbatively, non-perturbatively, that means that for arbitrary value of the string coupling GS, we have a variety of higher dimensional objects. Let me call them solitonic objects. Appear. And this is not philosophically different from what you expect from the quantum field theory, as we saw in some early examples, where you expect when you vary your coupling, you expect the appearance of some degrees of freedom that perturbatively they look as elementary excitations, and when you vary the coupling, you have other excitations that were suppressed in this limit, but then they become more dynamical. They're extremely massive in this limit, but then they become less massive, and you can talk in terms of the light and heavy degrees of freedom, and if you vary the coupling from weak to strong, then they sort of interchange the roles. So that's a field theory picture, but it also philosophically it also applies to strings. So you have this DP brains, and so they are dynamical and quantum hypersurfaces. With p plus one dimensional world volume, on which open strings can end, and we have the following classification for these brains in type to A and type to B theory. So the stable NDP brains exist for P equal to even number of 0, 2, 4, 6, 8. And here we have odd brains, 1, 3, 5, 7, and with some restrictions, 9. So that's a separate story. So some restrictions apply. So again, you can think of them as the analogs of carriers of electric charge, namely electrons, for example. But now they have different world volume, they're not point-like particles. Now, so they are charged. So DP brains are charged. For example, our main character, D3 brain, is charged with respect to this four-form potential, self-dual, so this dagger would correspond to the self-duality condition. And they have finite mass per unit volume, which is typically, so the tension will be 1 over GS. Now, one remark that you should carry in mind is that not all brains are D brains. So, for example, there exist also the so-called NS brains, charged under NS charges, and also M brains in 11-dimensional supergravity. Perhaps. So this will play some interesting role also. So maybe we'll include some exercises and tutorials for these M brains. But fundamentally, they are not, from the point of view of supergravity solutions, they are not fundamentally different from the solutions that we saw yesterday. And there are also various. Let me call them phenomenological brains. In which appear as in, for example, numerous brain worlds scenarios. But they're not necessarily related to string theory. So depending on what you're going to do in your life, you might encounter different incarnations of the word brain, and just be aware that not all brains are necessarily solutions of these. So you can discover, especially in these phenomenological scenarios, there's a variety of various brains with, in some sense, inspired by this string theory story, but they're not necessarily brains that solve equations of motion. So the first question when you encounter some brain construction in any research paper is to ask yourself whether or not this brain actually solves some equations of motion, right? And which ones? Okay. And if the authors are not very clear on that is a source of suspicion. And so, yeah. So yep. So this means that remember we had this F5, which was dA4, and F5 obeyed the self-duality condition. So this just reminds us of that. Yeah. So there's nothing. Just to say that A4 is a form whose field strength is self-dual. Nothing more. Okay. So how do we? So the picture that I had last time was the following. So you have a world volume of a brain which has p plus one dimensions, and these objects are characterized, so they are heavy. They are characterized by mass per unit volume, mass density, and a charge density, QD. But otherwise, fundamentally, they're not. So they are extended objects, but you can always think of an electron as an analog, as a zero dimensional. So for electron P will be, not electron, but a point-like brain. In fact, there is a zero D0 brain also, will be characterized by P equals zero, right? Zero. All right. So now, what we want to describe, so when I say it's a hypersurfaces, right, on which open strings can end, well, this is a classical picture. Our strings, of course, are quantized, so they have spectra of excitations. All of this is quantum mechanical, meaning vibrating according to rules of quantum mechanics, or quantum field theory, and at arbitrary energy, the brain is a locus, right? So you have this infinite number of these open strings which end at some hypersurface in 10-dimensional space-time. All of this is vibrating according to this quantum mechanical rules. And at arbitrary energy, it's not so easy to describe what exactly these vibrations are. So again, so think of our 3 plus 1 dimensional normal world as such a brain at each point of which there is some open strings which then goes into higher dimension. And depending on which energies we probe, so we can probe fairly low energies, for example, right now in the room, right? So these are energies which are much less than the Planckian energy, for example. So only low energy excitations of these strings are visible. Everything else is very heavy. And in order to excite this heavy degrees of freedom, we need to build some powerful accelerator, or we need somehow to probe things which are, for example, of TeV scale, right? We need to accelerate our proton and so on, right? So what we observe is a low energy world, and in that sense, when you want to look at the description, so at this low energy, so what is the adequate description of the brain itself, right? Well, it is a description of this room, if you want, in terms of the appropriate degrees of freedom. What are the appropriate degrees of freedom? Well, the appropriate degrees of freedom will be, for example, quarks and gluons, right, and then electrons and leptons and neutrinos and so on. So these are the particles or elementary excitations which are appropriate at the energy scale at which we want to describe our surface of this, for example, D free brain. So then it means that at low energy, right? So and every time I say low energy, that means that the energy which is much less than M string, which is one over, this is the only scale that appears in the game, we have fluctuations. Of DP brain are determined by the quantum spectrum of open strings attached to it. And at low energies, only massless modes will be of interest. And the massless modes will be gauge fields, mu, from 0 to p. And so here x, so x are p plus 1 dimensional coordinates on the world volume of a brain. And there are also scalars of x. So I is going to 1 to 9 minus p. So these are scalars. Plus, so these are the main excitations that describe these fluctuations of these open strings at low energy in the low energy limit. Plus superpartners, because these are bosonic fields, plus superpartners. Right? And then there are also massive modes, right? And then, of course, and plus massive modes with energies with mass of the order of 1 over LS, but again, we will not look into them. So the story is very similar to what you have in quantum field theory when you consider solitons and associated object domain walls and so on. So let me formulate this as a remark for your or a hyperlink for your self-study. So these massless modes, are the familiar collective coordinates of as in collective coordinates of solitons as in quantum field theory. So so I will give you the appropriate references, but we will not go into any kind of depth there because that will take many, many hours. So you can look at these lectures by Jeff Harvey, but also this book by Rajaraman. And there are also books by Rubakov, Valery Rubakov. I think at least some of them are definitely translated into English, at least one for sure, and he had several more, which in detail sort of discusses these solitonic quantizations in fermionic and bosonic case. And you can look at Amazon, for example. I will include this also in the reference. But I think one book is definitely translated into English, and it's called the Classical Theory. So Classical Theory of Gauge Fields by Rubakov. Gauge fields. So these are collective coordinates, and so they are. Goldstone bosons. Associated with the spontaneous symmetry breaking. By the brains. Right. So clearly, I mean, if you insert a hypersurface in this room, then you break various symmetries, right? You break translation invariance and so on and so forth. So these fields can be considered as Goldstone bosons. Now, if you have multiple brains, then the picture. So you'll discover that in addition to abelian fields, so if you have one brain, then to this a mu will be an abelian field. Now non-abelian fields appear if you have multiple brains. So the picture that people like to draw doesn't mean that. Right. So you have strings that ends whose endpoints are on one of the brains, for example, and these are massless. So the low energy excitations are massless U1 fields. Let's say a mu, but you can also have strings which stretch between brains, and in addition to the same fields, some multiple strings like that, and these strings will describe the massive gauge fields. With mass, which is proportional to r over 2 pi alpha prime, then r is taken to 0. So these are massive, if you want, these are W bosons, then you analyze the spectrum. So we are not, so this is, again, so this is some hyperlink for you to work with. When this massive, so these are massive gauge bosons, if you want, and then you, when you take these brains to coalesce, to coincide, and take R to 0, then you discover 4 massless fields. And they have the following structure, AB, right? And this belongs to, so these are for two brains, right? So two brains. That belongs to U2, where A and B are 1 and 2. And you also have scalars that have these indices in the adjoint of U2, right? So this construction is described in detail in various sources, but the original and probably the most lucid, well, okay, fairly lucid one is by Witten in 95. So you can spend some time of convincing yourself that this is indeed the case from the spectrum of the strings that end on the brain. So for us, this is just an illustration of, so what we want is to understand what kind of theory, I mean, to understand, again, so to understand this in detail, you need to spend significant time on kind of analyzing all this thing and reading this and many other papers that associated with this. So what I want to illustrate is that it is not unexpected that you get the low energy degrees of freedom that describe the motion of these strings, motion of these brains, and fluctuations at low energies, which are the brains in a way, right? Because if you look at this room, right, you ask, okay, so what is our free Poisson dimensional world? Well, our free Poisson dimensional world is a collection of fields and the excitations, right? The particles of which the whole thing is made, right? So that's the particles of which these brains are made, so to speak. And the statement is that the dynamics of these massless modes is governed by some non-abelian gauge theory. Non-abelian gauge theory. So if we consider, so which non-abelian gauge theory depends on what kind of brain we consider. And if we consider, so we are kind of aiming at a construction that gives us the ADS-CVT correspondence. So we consider NC, not two, but NC D3 brains in type 2B theory. So then the massless spectrum will contain the gluon A mu. Then there are scalars, so I going from 1 to 6. And then there are also superpartners, so these are 4 wild fermions and all fields in the adjoint of UN. See, in the adjoint odd of U and C, and the low energy effective action. So there is a story of how to, right? So these are just words, right? So, but of course you need to understand what kind of effective action or what kind of Lagrangian governs these excitations. And the low energy effective action for these fields is the one of n equals 4 UNC supersymmetric Young Mills in 4 dimensions, which is a theory well known before. Well known before, whose Lagrangian in one incarnation like will resemble QCD in some sense, but it will resemble QCD because, okay, it has this f mu, right, to trace because it's non-abelian. Then you have f mu, but then there are also these scalars. So unfortunately, it's not just free muons, right? So fi sum over mu and I, and then there are terms of this type. So commutators, because these are matrices, right? Remember, these are nc by nc matrices. So there is a non-trivial commutator squared, and then there are also fermions attached to it. Now, this theory, so later on, we will see that G squared Young Mills will be related to the string coupling, to the string coupling G string by the following equation. And you may feel that, okay, so this is all great, but then, you know, you wrote some Lagrangian, but now, oh, why don't you just prove what you said, right? And there is a story behind this which we are not going to consider, but the story exists, and it is a fairly non-trivial story, in some sense similar to the. So what you would like to know, I'm sure, is where this thing is coming from, right? So I'm just saying in words that you have some brains and you have a coincident brains, and then suddenly out of some hat or out of the blue you have some Lagrangian, and you feel kind of forced to believe that this is the case. Now, there is a story behind this which we'll not discuss, but at least I'll try to say a few words about the logic and philosophy of where this thing is coming from. It is coming from the analog. So remember when we wrote this type 2B low energy equations of motion, we did this based on the requirement that the symmetries of our string propagating in external fields relevant for a closed string theory, namely the graviton and other fields which appear in the spectrum of closed string theory, that the action of a string maintains its symmetries on a quantum level. So that led to the calculation of these beta functionals, and I mentioned at the time that this calculation is a non-trivial business, which was done in mid-1980s, and that calculation would lead to stringy corrections, the infinite alpha prime series corrections to the Einstein's equations of motion. And based on that, we can write down the type 2B low energy effective action and find our brain solutions and so on, right? So now what is happening here is a hand waving, which refers to the other side of the story. Now you want to do something similar to that statement of computing beta functionals at low energy but in the language of open strings. So you want to write effective actions that describe the behavior of open strings at low energies. Now, an open string spectrum will not contain a graviton, but it will contain gauge fields. And in the mid-80s again, and late 80s, people were doing similar calculations, similar to ones that gave corrections to the closed string theory equations of motion. This is Einstein's equations of motion that we wrote on board several days ago. And now you are supposed to do a similar type of calculations for open string theory. And that has been done. There is a long, painful story, well, relatively painful story, which, again, I'm happy to discuss with those of you who are interested. So there are some names attached to the story, by notably by Rob Lee and Fratkin and Zeitlin and other people. And all of that resulted in the statement like this. So there is a hidden, so this is a hyperlink, if you want, right? So I understand that this may be frustrating, but we will not. I mean, this will take another course on how to explain why this is happening, right? So now this theory that appears, and mostly we will be focused on this theory of coincident D3 brains with this Lagrangian. Simply because that's the original example of. You had a question? No.
Yes, this particular example where we have only. Are we ignoring the higher form fields because?
Yeah.
Are they are they too high in energy or particular to this particular brain?
So if you look at the spectrum, right? So you will see that yes, there are also fluxes. Which are there, right? But they can be consistently put to zero, and you can consider only the kind of the lowest. Yeah. These fields. So the lowest. Yeah. So let me think. The lowest fields that will appear there. They will contain the gauge fields, and there might be, I'm not quite sure what happens to other low energy fields such as forms, right? And so P, suddenly presumably are there. Presumably they are there. So I don't remember. I mean, the ultimate thing is that, of course, all of them, like in closed string theory, all of these things should be taken into account in the effective action. And this is kind of the one illustration ignoring perhaps the other formed fields, but for D3 brains, so these are the only ones that are excited. Okay, for other brains, perhaps there are some form. I'm not sure what happens to, but that can be found. I can find out. Right. So. So for coincident D3 brains, right? So we have this Lagrangian, and this theory, as I said, it was well known before, and it has some interesting properties that we will mention. Right. So so one interesting property is that this theory appears to have a vanishing beta function, which is very non-trivial. result. Now, you can do actually, perhaps it's a nice exercise to check it at one loop based on the fields that appear there, that in a way the application of formulas in Peskin and Schroeder or somewhere else. But if you look at free loop, so that was known in free loops. That was computed in 1980. The interesting fact about this calculation was that it was probably the first ever application of computer algebra to Feynman diagrams. So that's the reference for people who are interested in that. And then you can look at the references, so see reference list for various versions of the proof that this is indeed true perturbatively to all orders. So for proofs that the result is true perturbatively, mostly due to Mandelstam, and non-perturbatively. Right, so I again, so this is something that will not, this proofs will not discuss. Now, one remark is, which pragmatically will be important, is that this relationship between the string coupling constant and the G Young-Mills, this implies a particular choice of normalization of the Young-Mills generators. So you may remember, so in general, the generators of Young-Mills, the normalized like this, and in general, therefore, we have G squared Young-Mills, because this constant is arbitrary, so 2 pi. So sometimes in the literature, you will see a different normalization. So don't be surprised. So the standard choice in gauge theory is C equal to 1/2, as you can see in many textbooks, and that gives you this this relationship that we'll be using. So the moral of that story is with beta equal to 0, the coupling constant G Young-Mills is scale independent and does not run with energy. So, so this means that it is a true, so it is true constant in the sense that you can set it equal to, so G, you can set it equal to 100, and it stays 100 no matter what. Now, another remark is that this U and C can always be decomposed as U and C cross U1. And this U1 part can be decoupled, and it describes motion of the center of mass of the NC brains, of the system of NC brains, right? So there is one degree of freedom that describes the motion of this stack of this NC brains as a whole, and the rest is SU and C. So the parameters of this gauge theory are so unlike in QCD where it's the recoupling runs of energy, so parameters of n equals 4 superonic minimals will be nc. That coincides with what we do in QCD, but also G Young-Mills, which can be set to constant. And in the large NC limit, the perturbative expansion of any amplitude can be written in the following form. So it could be entropy, for example, or some cross section or something like that. G and Mills and NC as a series root 2 infinity and c to power 2 minus 2 g, then fg of lambda, where lambda is g squared Young-Mills and c is at Hooft coupling. So this is again something that is coming out of the blue, but it's a hyperlink. And what you can look at is the Sidney Coleman lectures, books. There is a book, right, it's Ricci lectures. And there is also a book by Yuri Makeyenko, which is fairly recent. And the story of large N gauge theory is told there. So again, so just like there, we ignore this infinitely long, complicated, very interesting story. And this is the only ingredient that we'll borrow from that. So what we expect to see, so ultimately, of course, we'll have this gravity description of this theory, or a string theory description of this theory. And what we want to see as emerging from dual gravity or dual string theory is an infinite series of this type in inverse powers of nc. So the Lon philosophy, again, so going back to the attempts to solve QCD and find, for example, what is known, was known in the 70s, the master field theory, namely the leading contribution. So if g is equal to 0, we start with nc squared, but this function f naught of lambda is still a non-trivial and unknown. So this in general, this function is unknown, right, for if you want any amplitude, right? So only in few examples, even for n equals 4, this function is known explicitly. But if you ask me, for example, you know, you compute the free energy of your theory, and it is supposed to be given by this expansion. So for free energy of the theory, f naught is known in the two limits, in the limit of weak coupling and strong coupling, but it's not known fully. There are some examples, especially in recent years with all these advances in integrability in n equals 4. There are examples where these a's are known for all lambdas. But again, so this is only leading order in nc and only for a certain number of these amplitudes. So let's say free energy or viscosity is still, we don't even know f naught, not to mention this whole series. But nonetheless, it is some progress. So what ADS CFT would allow us, of course, you can compute f naught of lambda for weak coupling perturbatively. And our goal is to compute lambda in the opposite limit of infinite coupling. And perhaps in some examples, like very special form Wilson loops, it will be possible to compute it for any value of lambda. But our goal is transport and thermodynamics in transport. And I'm not aware of any example where for these quantities, f naught was computed exactly for all values of lambda. But even knowing this in two limits, it's already some progress. All right. So next time we will write down the going to do next time. We'll write down the limits. So we'll discuss the limits in which we can actually connect between the open string description and closed string description, and then do various experiments, notably some scattering experiments in two cases, and we'll discover that two sides are actually equal to each other and describing the same one in the same theory, but in the opposite values of the coupling, and that will lead us to this secret equation that we were looking for from the first lecture, namely that a partition function of one theory can be reformulated in terms of different degrees of freedom, and we'll have an equation that z1 or z of j is equal to z tilde of j tilde. So we'll change variables in our path integral effectively, and with the help of this change of variables, we'll be able to compute the correlation functions and other quantities which will be needed for analyzing the hydrodynamic limit of a theory, in particular in transport and other properties. All right, so that will be all for